Chapter 4, Part 2 of The Worst Journey in the World, Volume 1, by Apsley Cherry Garrard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 4, Land, Part 2. The second adventure was the loss of the third motor sledge. It was Sunday morning, January 8th, and Scott had given orders that this motor was to be hoisted out of the ship.
This was done first thing, and the motor placed on firm ice. Later, Campbell told me one of the men had dropped a leg through crossing a sludgy patch some 200 yards from the ship. I didn't consider it very serious, as I imagined the man had only gone through the surface crust. At about 7 a.m. I started for the shore, with a single man load, leaving Campbell looking about for the best crossing for the motor. I find a note in my own diary as to what happened after that. Last night the ice was getting very soft in places, and I was a little doubtful about leading ponies over a spot on the route to the hut, which is about a quarter of a mile from the ship. It has been thawing very fast the last few days, and has been very hot as Antarctic weather goes. This morning it was the same, and Bailey went in up to his neck. Some half hour after the motor was put on the floe, we were told to tow it onto firm ice, as that near the ship was breaking up. All hands started on a long tow line. We got onto a rotten piece, and somebody behind shouted, "You must run!" From that moment everything happened very quickly. Williamson fell right in through the ice. Immediately afterwards we were all brought up with a jerk. Then the line began to pull us backwards. The stern of the motor had sunk through the ice, and the whole car began to sink. It slowly went right through and disappeared, and then the tow line followed it. Everything possible was done to hang on to the rope, but in the end we had to let it go, each man keeping his hold until he was dragged to the lip of the hole. Then we made for the fast ice, leaving the rotten bit between us and the ship. Pennell and Priestley sounded their way back to the ship, and Day asked Priestley to bring his goggles when he returned. They came back with the lifeline, Pennell leading. Suddenly the ice gave way under Priestley, who disappeared entirely, and came up, so we learned afterwards, under the ice, there being a big current. In a moment Pennell was lying flat upon the floe on his chest, and got his hand under Priestley's arm, and so pulled him out. All Priestley said was, "Day, here are your goggles." We all got back to the ship, but communication between the ship and the shore was interrupted for the rest of the day, when a solid road was found right up to the ship in another place. Meanwhile the hut was rising very quickly, and Davis, who was Chippy Chap, the carpenter, deserves much credit. He was a leading shipwright in the Navy, always willing and bright, and with a very thorough knowledge of his job. I have seen him called up hour after hour, day and night, on the ship, when the pumps were choked by the coal balls which formed in the bilges, and he was always arrived with a smile on his face. Altogether he was one of our most useful men. In this job of hut-building he was helped by two of our seamen, Kean and Abbott, and others. Latterly, I believe, there were more people working than there were hammers. A plan of this hut is given here. It was 50 feet long by 25 feet wide, and 9 feet to the eaves. The insulation, which was very satisfactory, was seaweed, sewn up in the form of a quilt.
The sides have double matchboarding inside and outside the frames, with a layer of our excellent quilted seaweed insulation between each pair of boardings. The roof has a single matchboarding inside, but on the outside is a matchboarding, then a layer of two-ply rubberoid, then a layer of quilted seaweed, then a second matchboarding, and finally a cover of three-ply rubberoid.
The floor consisted of a wooden boarding, next the frame, then a quilt of seaweed, then a layer of felt upon which was a second boarding, and finally linoleum. We thought we should be warm, and we were. In fact, during the winter, with 25 men living there, and the cooking range going, and perhaps also the stove at the other end, the hut not infrequently became fuggy, big though it was. The entrance was through a door in a porch, before you got to the main door. In the porch were the generators of the acetylene gas, which was fitted throughout by Day, who was also responsible for the fittings of the ventilator, cooking range and stove, the chimney pipes from these running along through the middle of the hut before entering a common vent. Little heat was lost. The pipes were fitted with dampers and air inlets which could be opened or shut at will to control the ventilation. Besides a big ventilator in the top of the hut, there was an adjustable air inlet also at the base of the chamber, which formed the junction of the two chimneys. The purpose of this was also ventilation, but it was not successful. The bulkhead which separated the men's quarters, or mess deck, from the rest of the hut, was formed of such cases as contained goods in glass, including wine, which would have frozen and broken outside. The bulkhead did not go as high as the top of the hut. When the contents of a case were wanted, a side of the box was taken out and the empty case then formed a shelf. We started to live in the hut on January the 18th, beautifully warm, the gramophone going and everybody happy. But for a long time before this, most of the landing party had been living in tents on shore. It was very comfortable, far more so than might be supposed, judging only by the popular idea of polar life. We were now almost landed. There were just a few things more to come over from the ship. It was blowing a mild blizzard from the south, and I took a sledge over to the ship, which was quite blotted out in blinding snow at times. It was as hard to get an empty sledge over as generally it is to drag a full one. Tea on the ship, which was very full of welcome, but also very full of the superiority of their own comforts over those of the land. Their own comforts were not so very obvious, since they had tried to get the stove in the wardroom going for the first time. They were all coughing in the smoke, and everything inside was covered with smuts. The hut itself was some 12 feet above the sea, and situated upon what was now an almost sandy beach of black lava. It was thought that this was high enough to be protected from any swell likely to arrive in such a sheltered place, but, as we shall see, Scott was very anxious as to the fate of the hut, when, on the depot journey, a swell removed not only miles of sea ice and a good deal of barrier, but also the end of the glacier tongue. We never saw this beach again, for the autumn gales covered it with thick drifts of snow, and the thaw was never enough to remove this for the other 2 summers we spent here. There is no doubt this was an exceptional year for thaw. We never again saw a little waterfall such as was now tumbling down the rocks from Skua Lake into the sea. The little hill of 66 feet high behind us was soon named Wind Vane Hill, and there were other meteorological instruments there besides. A snowdrift or ice drift always forms to leeward of any such projection, and that beneath this hill was large enough for us to drive into it 2 ice caves. The first of these was to contain our larder, notably the frozen mutton carcasses brought down by us from New Zealand in the ice house on deck. These, however, showed signs of mildew, and we never ate very freely of them. Seal and penguin were our stock meat foods, and mutton was considered to be a luxury. The second cave, 13 feet long by 5 feet wide, hollowed out by Simpson and Wright, was for the magnetic instruments. The temperature in these caves was found to be fairly constant. Unfortunately, this was the only drift into which we could tunnel, and we had no such mass of snow and ice as is afforded by the barrier, which can be burrowed, and was burrowed extensively by Amundsen and his men. The cases containing the bulk of our stores were placed in stacks, arranged by Bowers, up on the sloping ground to the west of the hut, beginning close to the entrance door. The sledges lay on the hillside above them. This arrangement was very satisfactory during the first winter, but the excessive blizzards of the second winter, and the immense amount of snow which was gathering about the camp, caused us to move everything up to the top of the ridge behind the hut, where the wind kept them more clear. Amundsen found it advisable to put his cases in 2 long lines. The dogs were tethered to a long chain or rope. The ponies' stable was built against the northern side of the hut, and was thus sheltered from the blizzards, which always blow here from the south. Against the south side of the hut, Bowers built himself a storeroom.
Every day he conceives or carries out some plan to benefit the camp.
Scott seems very cheery about things, I find in my diary about this time, and well he might be. A man could hardly be better served. We slaved until we were nearly dead beat, and then we found something else to do until we were quite dead beat. Ship's company and landing parties alike, not only now but all through this job, did their very utmost, and their utmost was very good. The way men worked was fierce.
If you can picture our house, nestling below this small hill on a long stretch of black sand, with many tons of provision cases ranged in neat blocks in front of it, and the sea lapping the ice foot below, you will have some idea of our immediate vicinity. As for our wider surroundings, it would be difficult to describe their beauty in sufficiently glowing terms. Cape Evans is one of the many spurs of Erebus, and the one that stands closest under the mountain, so that always towering above us we have the grand snowy peak with its smoking summit. North and south of us are deep bays, beyond which great glaciers come rippling over the lower slopes to thrust high blue walled snouts into the sea. The sea is blue before us, dotted with shining bergs or ice floes, whilst far over the sound, yet so bold and magnificent as to appear near, stand the beautiful western mountains, with their numerous lofty peaks, their deep glacial valley, and clear-cut scarps, a vision of mountain scenery that can have few rivals.
Before I left England, people were always telling me the Antarctic must be dull without much life. Now we are in ourselves a perfect farmyard. There are 19 ponies 50 yards off and 30 dogs just behind, and they howl like the wolves they are at intervals, led by Dick. The skuas are nesting all round and fighting over the remains of the seals which we have killed, and the penguins which the dogs have killed, whenever they have got a chance. The collie bitch, which we have brought down for breeding purposes, wanders about the camp. A penguin is standing outside my tent, presumably because he thinks he is going to molt here. A seal has just walked up into the horse lines. There are plenty of Weddell and penguins and whales. On board we have Nigger and a blue Persian kitten, with rabbits and squirrels. The whole place teems with life. Frankie Drake is employed all day wandering round for ice for watering the ship. Yesterday he had made a pile out of the floe, and the men wanted to have a flag put on it, and have it photographed and called Mr. Drake's Furthest South. January 25th was fixed as the day upon which 12 of us, with 8 ponies and the 2 dog teams, were to start south to lay a depot upon the barrier for the polar journey. Scott was of opinion that the bays between us and the Hut Point Peninsula would freeze over in March, probably early in March, and that we should most of us get back to Cape Evans then. At the same time, the ponies could not come down over the cliffs of this tongue of land, and preparations had to be made for a lengthy stay at Hut Point for them and the keepers. For this purpose, Scott meant to use the old Discovery Hut at Hut Point. On January 15th he took Mears and one dog team and started for Hut Point, which was 15 statute miles to the south of us. They crossed Glacier Tongue, finding upon it a depot of compressed fodder and maize which had been left by Shackleton. The open water to the west nearly reached the Tongue. On arrival at the hut, Scott was shocked to find it full of snow and ice. This was serious, and, as we found afterwards, the drifted snow had thawed down into ice. The whole of the inside of this hut was a big ice block. In the middle of this ice was a pile of cases left by the Discovery as a depot. They were, we knew, full of biscuit.
There was something too depressing in finding the old hut in such a desolate condition. I had had so much interest in seeing all the old landmarks and the huts apparently intact. To camp outside and feel that all the old comforts and cheer had departed was dreadfully heart-rending. That night we slept badly till the morning, and therefore late. After breakfast we went up the hills. There was a keen southeasterly breeze, but the sun shone, and my spirits revived. There was very much less snow everywhere than I have ever seen. The ski run was completely cut through in 2 places, the Gap and Observation Hill almost bare, a great bare slope on the side of Arrival Heights, and on top of Crater Heights, an immense bare tableland. How delighted we should have been to see it like this in the old days. The pond was thawed, and the confervae green in fresh water. The hole which we had dug in the mound in the pond was still there, as Mears discovered by falling into it up to his waist and getting very wet. On the south side we could see the pressure ridges beyond Pram Point, as of old. Horseshoe Bay calm and unpressed, the sea ice pressed on Pram Point, and along the Gap ice front, and a new ridge running around Cape Armitage about 2 miles off. We saw Ferrer's old thermometer tubes standing out of the snow slope, as though they'd been placed yesterday. Vince's cross might have been placed yesterday, the paint was so fresh, and the inscriptions so legible. We had 2 officers who had been with Shackleton in his 1908 expedition, Priestley, who was in our northern party, and Day, who was in charge of our motors. Priestley, with 2 others, sledged over to Cape Royds, and has left an account of the old hut there. After pitching tent, Levick and I went over to the hut to forage. On the way, I visited Derrick Point, and took a large 7-pound tin of butter while Levick opened up the hut. It was very dark inside, but I pulled the boarding down from the windows so we could see all right. It was very funny to see everything lying about us just as we had left it, in that last rush to get off in the lull of the blizzard. On Marston's bunk was a 6-penny copy of The Story of Bessie Costrell, which someone had evidently read and left open. Perhaps what brought the old times back again more than anything else was the fact that, as I came out of the larder, the sleeve of my windclothes caught the tap of the copper and turned it on. When I heard the drip of the water, I turned instinctively and turned the tap off, almost expecting to hear Bob's raucous voice cursing me for my clumsiness. Perhaps what strikes one more forcibly than anything else is the fact that nothing has been disturbed. On the table was the remains of a batch of bread that Bob's had cooked for us, and that was only partially consumed before the Nimrod called for us. Some of the rolls showed the impression of bites given to them in 1909.
All around the bread were sauces, pickles, pepper and salt of our usual standing lunch, and a half-opened tin of gingerbreads was a witness to the dryness of the climate, for they were still crisp as the day they were opened. In the cubicle near the larder were the loose tins that poor Armitage and myself had collected from all round the hut before we left. On the shelves of my cubicle are still stacked the magazines and paper bought down by the relief ship. Nothing is changed at all except the company. It is almost dismal. I expect to see people coming through the door after a walk over the surrounding hills. We had not much time to look round us, for Campbell was cooking in the tent, so we slung a few tins of jam, a plum pudding, some tea and gingerbreads into a sack and returned to camp. By this time it was snowing heavily and continued to do so after dinner, so that we turned in immediately, 1:30 p.m, and went off to sleep. One thing worth mentioning is that on several of the drifts are well-defined hoof marks, some of them looking so new that we could have sworn they had been made this year. The old sport, Levick, gave us a start by suddenly announcing that he could see a ship quite close, and for some time we were on tenterhooks, but his ship proved to be the Terra Nova, ice-anchored off the Skuary. The whole place is very eerie. There is such a feeling of life about it. Not only do I feel it, but the others do also. Last night, after I turned in, I could have sworn that I heard people shouting to each other. I thought that I had only got an attack of nerves, but Campbell asked me if I had heard any shouting, for he had certainly done so. It must have been the seals calling to each other, but it certainly did sound most human. We are getting so worked up that we should not be a bit surprised to see a settlement of Japanese or some other such people some day, when we stroll round towards Black Sands Beach. The old sport created some amusement this evening by opening a tin of Nestle's milk at both ends instead of making the two holes at one end. He informed us that he had got so used to using two whole tins of milk for cocoa for 14 people at night that he always opened them that way. As a consequence, we have to spend most of our spare time making bungs to keep the milk in the tin. Meanwhile, as was to be expected, the action of the, I suspect, abnormal summer sea temperature was showing its effect upon the sea ice. Sea ice thaws from below when the temperature of the water rises. The northern ice goes out first here, being next to the open water, but big thaw pools form at the same time whenever a current of water flows over the shallows, as at the end of Cape Evans, Hut Point and Cape Armitage. On January 17th, the ice was breaking away between the point of Cape Evans and the ship, although a road still remained fast between the ship and the shore. The ship began to get up steam, but the fast ice broke away quickly that night. I believe they got steam in 3 hours, 12 hours being the time generally allowed, only just in time, however, for she broke adrift as it was reported. The next morning she made fast to the ice only 200 yards from the ice foot of the cape.
For the present the position is extraordinarily comfortable. With a southerly blow, she would simply bind on to the ice, receiving great shelter from the end of the cape. With a northerly blow she might turn rather close to the shore, where the soundings run to 3 fathoms, but behind such a stretch of ice she could scarcely get a sea or swell without warning. It looks a wonderfully comfortable little nook, but of course one can be certain of nothing in this place. One knows from experience how deceptive the appearance of security may be.
The ship's difficulties were largely due to the shortage of coal. Again, on the night of January 20 to 21st, we had an anxious time.
Fearing a little trouble, I went out of the hut in the middle of the night and saw at once that she was having a bad time. The ice was breaking with a northerly swell, and the wind increasing, with the ship on a dead lee shore. Luckily the ice anchors had been put well in on the floe, and some still held. Pennell was getting up steam, and his men struggling to replace the anchors. We got out the men and gave some help. At 6 steam was up, and I was right glad to see the ship back out to windward, leaving us to recover anchors and hawsers.
A big berg drove in just after the ship had got away, and grounded where she had been lying. The ship returned in the afternoon, and it seems that she was searching round for an anchorage, and trying to look behind this berg. There was a strongish northerly wind blowing. The currents and soundings round Cape Evans were then unknown. The current was setting strongly from the north through the strip of sea which divides Inaccessible Island from Cape Evans, a distance of some 2/3 of a mile. The engines were going astern, but the current and wind were too much for her, and the ship ran aground, being fast for some considerable distance aft, some said as far as the mainmast.
Visions of the ship failing to return to New Zealand, and of 60 people waiting here, arose in my mind with sickening pertinacity, and the only consolation I could draw from such imaginations was the determination that the southern work should go on as before, Meanwhile, the least ill possible seemed to be an extensive lightening of the ship with boats, as the tide was evidently high when she struck, a terribly depressing prospect. Some three or four of us watched it gloomily from the shore, whilst all was bustle on board, the men shifting cargo aft. Pennell tells me they shifted 10 tons in a very short time. The first ray of hope came when, by careful watching, one could see that the ship was turning very slowly. Then one saw the men running from side to side, and knew that an attempt was being made to roll her off. The rolling produced a more rapid turning movement at first, and then she seemed to hang again, but only for a short time. The engines had been going astern all the time, and presently a slight movement became apparent. But we only knew she was getting clear when we heard cheers on board, and more cheers from the whaler. Then she gathered stern way and was clear. The relief was enormous.
All this took some time, and Scott himself came back into the hut with us and went on bagging provisions for the depot journey. At such times of real disaster he was a very philosophical man. We were not yet ready to go sledging, but on January 23rd the ice in the North Bay all went out, and that in South Bay began to follow it. Because this was our road to the barrier, it was suddenly decided that we must start on the depot journey the following day, or perhaps not at all. Already it was impossible to get sledges south off the Cape, but there was a way to walk the ponies along the land until they could be scrambled down a steep, rubbly slope onto the sea ice which still remained. Would it float away before we got there? It was touch and go.
One breathes a prayer that the road holds for the few remaining hours. It goes in one place between a berg in open water and a large pool of the glacier face. It may be weak in that part, and at any moment the narrow isthmus may break away. We are doing it on a very narrow margin.
End of chapter 4, part 2.